Welcome to the Against the Stream Nashville podcast. We're very excited to announce that we are changing our name to Wild Heart Meditation Center. You can stay subscribed to the podcast as you currently are, or if you choose to join us again at a later date in the future, just remember to search wherever you get your podcasts for Wild Heart Meditation Center. We're excited to be introducing new facilitators to our group and expanding our presence in our local community. Enjoy. So tonight I'm going to talk about craving and clinging, two, I think, always relevant, ever-present qualities of mind. I've been giving a series of talks recently on the core or the foundational teachings that the Buddha offered, which are sometimes called the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And before I dive into talking about craving and clinging and how to work with those experiences, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, how the Buddha taught, which is something I've been revisiting each week. And two things are really important to me and I think really key to the Buddha's teaching that I want to highlight. One is that the Buddha really emphasized the importance of personal responsibility. And so if you look at his teachings, if you look at some of the early discourses in the Pali Canon, the Buddha demoted the role of gods in awakening and in transformation. And not that he denied that God or gods exist or don't exist. He wasn't interested in that type of theological discussion. But what he did say is that if we want to heal, if we want to get well, if we want to awaken, we have to do the work ourselves. No one's going to do that for us. We have to really look into the mind moment to moment and to become aware of our motivations, to bring awareness to how we communicate and speak and act, our behaviors, the consequences of the ways that we think, speak, and act. We have to really pay attention. And the Buddha also emphasized this other word in Pali Sanskrit. It's called ehipasiko, which means to come and see for yourself. So awakening is not a matter of, for the Buddha, a matter of philosophy or even a matter of theology or even a matter of spirituality. It's a matter of practice. You know, happiness is a collection of good habits. Contentment arises dependent upon my actions. Yeah. And we can see that in our lives. Like, when I do this, I get that. And when I do this, I get that. And each one of us has a unique set of conditions. We're born into unique conditions. We have unique genetic conditions. We have formative experiences in our life that shape who we are and how we relate to the world. And so to just say, hey, believe in this doctrine or follow this kind of rule or whatever it may be, would be a disservice to what awakening really involves, which is a moment-to-moment practice. And so I like this for myself because this is what made me feel comfortable about the Buddha's Dharma, his teaching, is that I wasn't really being asked to believe in anything that was going to do the work for me or to believe in any teaching or doctrine that was the commandment or the code of the world. But rather, I was being invited to practice, you know, and to look and to see and to, you know, really through careful investigation look into what causes, what conditions create suffering in my life and what causes and conditions lead to my well-being and the well-being of others. A couple weeks ago, I talked about the Buddha's first teaching, which is this task of inviting us to turn towards and to be interested in what is difficult in our lives. And this is a very radical first teaching. The Buddha didn't start with the solution. He started with the problem. He basically was asking us, is there a problem? Is there a problem? Is there something that's difficult? Is there something stressful? Is there something hard about being human? Is being human complex? Does it involve birth and aging, sickness and death? Does it involve sometimes getting what we don't want and being separated from what's dear to us? Does it involve the discomfort of expectations and the relational harm, the wounds of betrayal and abandonment and shame? Does it involve, is it hard? Have you noticed that? How do we make it harder for ourselves when it's already kind of hard, when we already have to cope with grief and sadness and loss and some of these, I call them the inarguables of life. What's inarguable about life? One is that life is stressful. Life requires constant upkeep. We have to keep paying the bills. We have to keep working. We have to keep up. You sweep the corner of the room and you go back there a couple weeks later and there's fucking dust in the corner of the room again. So there's this kind of like stress. There's this thread of like work. Life is work. Yeah, and not to be nihilistic. Again, this isn't about belief. It's not saying, we're not really saying believe that. We're saying, is it like that? The other aspect of this dukkha, this first noble truth, is that life is not quite in joint. It's a little bit disjointed. There's some dis-ease. There's some hiccups. We walk into the house and you turn on the light and the light goes out and then you stub your toe on the corner of the chair and then you get a phone call from your boss saying that you missed your deadline, but you had on your calendar that it was next week. And, life is kind of being thrown at us in pieces. And we try, and this is what we're going to talk about tonight, we try to organize it. We try to get certainty and stability to the best of our ability. And that's good. Like, that's necessary. We know that our nervous system needs some stability, structure, consistency to feel safe. We want that. And there's this aspect of, like, in wanting security, we create more stress. Fixing and managing and controlling life to try to make it fit to our liking. When certain aspects of life just don't fit, they're a little bit disjointed. And how do we relate? How do we learn to practice, right? Because that's the invitation. It's not, as I'm saying, to believe, but to practice. How do we work with that? How do we work with the disjointedness of life? And on the bigger levels, dukkha, this practice of turning towards what's difficult, that's the word dukkha, sometimes means despair. It means grief. It means loss. And so amidst this human condition, that we are susceptible to change, that life can't quite be pieced together how we like it all the time, amidst all of this experience, we try to make it not so. We run around, as the Buddha says, getting involved in this and that. He says we kind of just scatter around. He calls it perpetual wandering. Without mindfulness, we kind of just reactively try to push and pull on things to make them fit. And we can do that for some time, and it's okay that we do that, but we get lost in the push and pull, and that's when we suffer. When we get lost in reactivity, which I talked about last week. And the parable behind this is something called the second arrow, which is summarized, to oversimplify it, pain in life is inevitable. Change in life is inevitable. Suffering is optional. How we relate to the pain, that's what we have agency over. How do we meet and experience pain with compassion, with understanding, with empathy, with care, with concern, with having enough space and time for it even? You ever notice you don't have enough space and time for some of the difficult things in life? I notice that I kind of have this tendency to sweep things under the rug, and it's like, well, I'll get to it one of these days. And so when we slow down, we can learn how to look at our reactivity, our impulsivity, how we jump and try to fix, manage, and control. We experience birth, aging, sickness, death. We experience separation and loss. The future is uncertain. The past is gone. We lose hold of stability and enjoyment from temporary things. And we react. Sometimes we demand that these parts of our lives are different. We struggle and we fight with the storm. You know, and when you try to fight a storm, it doesn't always work out. The storm overcomes us and we just get lost in the fighting. And sometimes we even deny that the storm's even there. And then we still get swept away and lost. And so what to do? The Buddha introduced this kind of middle path. Well, how do we walk amidst the storm? And he even talks about taking refuge, taking shelter from the storm. We take refuge in our sila, in ethical practices, in living along with our values. And that's just a matter of intention, checking in on a daily basis. What do I value? Am I living in line with my values? We take refuge from the storm with mindfulness, with awareness. You know, by being able to watch the storm and seeing how we make the storm worse. And we take refuge with our wisdom and with the wisdom of others, with wise association, with support. We can practice meeting the complexity and the vulnerability of life moment to moment with ethical training, mindfulness, community, and experiential and collective wisdom. So it's not our fault that we fight, right? That the nervous system is biologically designed to want comfort and to want to avoid discomfort. And when we're not mindful or aware, that's most of the time what the brain's going to kind of do. It's going to say, oh, this feels good, I'm going to do that. This is uncomfortable, I'm going to get away from that. And Melvin Connor, he's a neuroscientist, he studied they call this the default mode network, or kind of the static state of the human nervous system. And he found that in his studies that the chronic internal state of the human nervous system is best categorized as a subtle state of desire and anxiety. He says, best described by the phrase, I want, spoken with or without an object for the verb. We are a wanting system. We prioritize what feels good. This has been essential for our survival, finding foods in the wild that are high calories, high sugar. We go after those, we take those in because they gave us energy and they were harder to find. We prioritize connection, feeling attractive, because sexuality and attractiveness, praise and status help us to fit in the tribe. They help us to be a part of the tribe, to form families, to create, to connect. Human safety is directly correlated to our ability to connect. Our brains, the emotional regulation centers of our brains, are wired to connect. Mirror neurons, right? When you're a little infant, you learn how to regulate your emotions from your caregivers. They model and mirror your emotions to you. And there's a really great research around this. A guy named John Bowlby and a lady named Mary Ainsworth talked about attachment and how important it is that we connect. And so we prioritize our attachment. This is why so much of our reactivity, the suffering that we create for ourselves, is around self and other. Do I fit in? Do I compare? At whatever age I am I where I'm supposed to be? Am I in the right job, in the right place, with the right partner, at the right time? So much of our suffering, maybe it's just me, but so much of my suffering is ping-ponging around throughout the day, trying to get a sense of, do I fit? Is there something wrong with me? You know, and then some of us, we found a way to kind of go straight to the source as far as pleasure and pain goes, and our unconscious drives to get comfort and avoid pain. Addiction, an epidemic in our country. I don't know of anybody that hasn't been impacted by addiction in some way, whether it's at least a distant relative. Addiction runs rampant. And we're not succeeding in treating addiction. From a Buddhist perspective, the human condition is an addictive condition. Because we like to feel good. We like to feel comfort. We like to feel safe. Dopamine and norepinephrine, those are the chemicals that release and offer that to us. We go straight to the source, some people. So it makes sense, actually, that people want to drink and use drugs to excess. It's one of the best ways to regulate stress in the short term. It's one, I have not found a single thing more effective to feel good in the short term other than using drugs and alcohol. Drugs and alcohol saved my life. You know, when I was a kid and I had nobody around to help me feel safe and to manage my emotions with me, I found drugs and alcohol. And when I found drugs and alcohol, I found connection. And when I found connection, I felt safe. That was it. So on a simple level, what we're really looking to do is just kind of asking ourselves the question, and is the comfort that we call comfort, is it comfort? Is it truly satisfying? Does it lead to contentment, enjoyment? Is it a wholesome type of comfort, or is it the type of comfort that's really discomfort? Does that make sense? Like, there's this kind of, sometimes what I think is good for me, what feels good, is not always so good for me. And without active awareness, I just keep kind of rationalizing. And in neuroscience, again, they say that your human brain is a rationalizing brain. That the role of this upper brain system is to rationalize the drives of the lower brains. We have a rationalizing mind. And what I hope to convey, what was important to me in hearing the Buddhist teaching, is that it's not my fault. It's not my fault that I crave. It's not my fault that I want pleasure and want to avoid pain. The Buddha said craving is repetitive. It has nothing to do with you. He doesn't say you crave. He says craving arises, samyutana. He says craving arises. But it's our responsibility of how to work with that. How do we transmute craving into something that is wholesome and meaningful? You know, and this is a part of any spiritual path, any part of psychotherapy, any part of if anyone comes from the 12 steps. It's all about turning this base need for satiation and this kind of thirst to have comfort into having fulfillment. And the Buddhist path is, to kind of oversimplify, just a path, a way of practicing that. And so we want to look a little bit at, you know, how much of our daily experience is driven by seeking comfort or pleasure. Not a philosophical request or a theological commandment, but rather an invitation to tune into our motivations and our drives. And what is the underlying drive here? And it's important to talk a little bit about the difference between desire from a Buddhist perspective and craving. Sometimes the second noble truth, the Buddhist teaching on craving, is mistranslated as desire. That the cause of so much of our suffering in life is that we have desire. From a Buddhist psychology perspective, there's a whole book called the Abhidharma that breaks down the mind from a Buddhist perspective. And one of the mental factors is desire, and it's called an ethically variable mental factor, which means that desire can lean towards wholesomeness in moments, and it can lead towards unwholesomeness in moments. But it itself is a neutral mental state. So there, that means, are moments when desire is totally wholesome. It's fulfilling. It's good for us. It's needed. Without desire, we wouldn't be here tonight. You know, I often ask the question, you know, what brings us out? What got me here tonight? Some desire, some wholesome desire to sit, to try to get some peace of mind, or to be in a community, or just because we had nothing else to do and we didn't trust ourselves. So I want to read a little bit. There's this word in Pali Sanskrit called chanda, and it's a wholesome desire, and I want to read a little bit about it. I love this theme. This is about chanda. Desire as an eagerness to offer, to commit, to apply oneself to awakening is called chanda. It's a psychological yes, a choice, not a pathology. In fact, you could summarize Dharma training as the transformation of tanha, which is craving, into chanda. It's a process whereby we guide our volition, grab hold of the steering wheel, and travel with clarity towards our deeper well-being. So we're not trying to get rid of desire, which would take another kind of desire. Instead, we're trying to transmute it, to take it out of the window in the shadow of gratification and need, and use its aspiration and vigor to bring us into light and clarity. This is an essential part of what brings us out here. What we're interested in awakening, we're interested in healing, we're interested in, you know, going beyond the limits that our mind tells us we have. And that takes, that requires this eagerness to commit and to apply oneself to a path. You know, and this is something that I love about the Dharma too, is they call this the Dharma and discipline. I think for me, like, I'm so instant gratification, like, conditioned that I remember coming to meditate and being like, okay, this is totally going to cure my anxiety. People talking about anxiety. I sit down for 30 minutes and it made it worse. And I was like, oh my God, this sucks. This isn't even working. Right? But something in the Dharma talk, I think, helped keep me around, because it's a discipline. It takes practice. You know, anything that leads to well-being takes practice. And this requires chanda, an eagerness to commit and apply oneself to a goal. Now, tanha, which is craving, is not a choice. It's a reflex. It's the desire to pull something in and feed on it. It's the demanding the satisfaction of our desire. And it's often, throughout my day, unconscious. It's automatic. It is a desire that is never satisfied, Ajahn Sucitto says, because it just shifts from one emotional need to the next, from one sense of achievement to another. It is the desire that comes from a black hole of need, however small and manageable that need is. And so this is the demanding, right? The impulsive, compulsive kind of tendencies we have to fall into the same habits. And what the Buddha's saying is, you know, we can learn how to bring mindfulness to these impulsive, reactive moments. It's as simple as just stopping and bearing witness, observing the craving, you know, watching the mind tell us that we need it this way or we need it that way. Learning how to disengage from the urgency of the mind. I notice this tendency a lot that, especially in meditation, the mind tells us that, you know, you got to get up and do the thing we forgot to do, or we remember we have a good thought about next week and, you know, a project that we're working on, and the mind tells you, just get up, just go do it. It's urgent. You might forget. You know, and this is kind of the subtlety of this part of the mind. That's kind of this reactive pull. And so there are three types of craving I want to just briefly go over, and we can have some discussion around them. The first is what's called kama tanha. And kama tanha is craving for sensory input. And I want to read a little bit about kama tanha. If you abstain from any specific sense input for a few hours, you'll probably experience the itch and hankering of this thirst. It is a part of what motivates our day, isn't it? But when you look at it, this form of desire puts us in a pretty dependent and needy position because all those sensory things, the sights, the smells, the tastes, the feelings, the sounds, and even the thoughts, all of those sensory things pass and are subject to a supply that we can't always rely on. And because the fulfillment that sensory input provides doesn't last, it's a supply that gets exceeded by demand. In fact, the more you get used to sense gratification, the more you depend on it, and the more you want it. It's addictive. What we're really practicing with here is not, again, judging our desires that I want to go eat ice cream or I want to go see a good movie with a friend because that will feel good. Pleasure is not the problem. It's our addiction. It's our dependence. It's the need to have. It's that kind of unconscious movement for comfort. It's oftentimes the way we mask loneliness. It's the way we mask our feelings of separateness. It's the way that we cope and deal with shame and with pain and with grief as we move into these sensory experiences to distract. Not because they themselves are bad, but because when we unconsciously find ourselves dependent on them, as Ajahn Sucitto talks about, and they're fleeting, we have to replenish them. We have to go back. We have to get more. We have to keep it up. And then you get dukkha, stress. Hardest job I ever had was fueling a crack cocaine addiction. You know, I couldn't put that on my job resume. What job experience do you have? Well, I had a crack addiction for a couple years. That was pretty hard. I got a good work ethic. I got a lot done. Not anything I can show for it, but, you know, it takes work, this kind of keeping up in these subtle ways. And so, you know, another type of craving can sometimes be our judgment about our desires. And so we have to be really careful here. You know, we have to really look at, like, the first part of mindfulness is that the awareness is going to start to show up. And that's not always good news. You know, we see time and time again us falling into the same patterns. And the awareness is the greatest gift we could ever have, but it's a painful awareness. And so we have to practice this kind of compassion, self-forgiveness. We have to really see suffering as suffering. When I finally saw my drug and alcohol addiction to be what it was, which was suffering for myself and others. When I knew that intellectually, like people told me for a long time, you shouldn't smoke crack, that's not good for you, you shouldn't steal from people, you shouldn't. I knew that that was not good, right? You could ask me the first day after my DARE class in sixth grade and I would have told you drugs and alcohol are bad. That's not the problem. Educating people about addiction is not going to work. All right? We've got to get in there and to nurture, to care for addicts, to say there's more out of life than just a dependence. And we've got to do that with our own little instincts to go out and get dependent on our routines and our habits, not to meet it with shame and judgment, but to go in there and say, hey man, like, you don't have to do this. You can be with the loneliness for a moment. You can call a friend and they'll talk you through it. You don't have to go do that thing. You don't have to text the ex or, you know, whatever it might be. And so this is a kama tanha, craving for sensory input. And another thing that we practice, it's not a very popular topic, but has quite some depth to it. At face value, it's almost easy to skip over, which is the practice of renunciation, which means giving up what we don't need. And it's an interesting contemplative exercise. It's really looking at our lives, turning towards this difficult awareness and saying, what do I really need? And then what is the extra? What's the kind of, you know, the extra stuff that requires upkeep? And how do I practice what the Buddha calls sense restraint? Guarding the mind. I know I'm throwing out a lot of recovery and addiction examples tonight, but there's one that I really love where they say, if you don't want to get your hair cut, don't go to the barbershop. Right? And so this is what the Buddha means by sense restraint. We need to really have wise association. We have to associate with people that are on the path, that have an interest in our well-being. You know, and that there's oftentimes, when people get serious about Buddhist practice, a little bit of the discomfort that leads towards more comfort, which is the discomfort of letting go of some of the intensity and excitement of the things that aren't really any longer fulfilling us. They call this dispassion, that we start to become a little bit less interested in occupying our minds with senseless kind of cravings. And you notice this on retreat. I've sat a lot of long retreats, silent retreats. And part of the practices of silent retreat is, why is it silent? You know, it's not because it makes you a spiritual badass to be silent. It's because talking can be very stimulating. We get a lot of thoughts and views and opinions floating through here. The Buddha calls this frivolous chatter. Just kind of talking for the sake of talking, chit-chat. You know, so you restrain the senses and you say, okay, I'm not going to talk. I'm going to really go inward, and I'm not going to, you know, deal with that aspect for a little bit and see what happens. And the mind quiets down quite a bit when we're not feeding and consuming thoughts and views and opinions. I think about like social media and just the explosion of views and opinions and media. You know, and again, not to be puritanical, social media, it's great. We feel connected. There's a lot of beauty to that. And there's a lot of very unhealthy stimulation. It's just kind of feeding in here. You go on retreat, you eat what's freely offered to you. One of the interesting things I noticed about going on retreat is that eating becomes a little bit of a disappointment, because you eat and then it kind of muddles your mind. You feel really tired afterwards. And, you know, and again, right, we have to have balance around this. We got to look at like the difference between moderation and what that means for us individually and restriction. I work in the mental health field, with eating disorders and our relationship to food culturally, our relationship to bodies and how we view different bodies and how we have these ideals of beauty. There's a lot of delusion in here too, so we got to be careful. But looking at like what do we need to take in? The fifth precept in Buddhism is to refrain from intoxicating drinks and drugs that lead to heedlessness. The Buddha doesn't say stop drinking and using drugs because they're bad. He says because they'll probably make you do a bunch of shit that you regret. Or you'll lose mindfulness. Or, you know, you can develop a dependence. But I really like Thich Nhat Hanh. He reframes this, not as drugs and alcohol necessarily. He says to be wise and careful in our consumption of things, what we consume, what we take in through the senses. And so, you know, also, again, it's important to remember self-forgiveness, patience. One of the 10 perfections in Buddhism is patience. You know, because we're coming up against our drives and learning how to work with those with compassion and with care and getting support and, you know, really trying to actively, over time, work to change our behaviors instead of this kind of shame and guilt and regret that can just make it even harder to change. The other types of craving, something called bhava tanha and vibhava tanha, which means the craving to become and the craving to not become. Craving for existence, craving for becoming what you are not. That's bhava tanha, wanting to be someone, something. You know, a lot of times I see this manifest in my mind is what I call the I'd rather be's. I'd rather be somewhere else, with someone else, doing something else. Or sometimes I call them the if onlys. If only I had this in my life, or this experience, or this thing, the right job, the right place. The mind has this tendency to want to become. And it endlessly seems to be unsatisfied with who we are right now. Like, this isn't ever enough. That there's always, the grass is always greener, right? And sometimes this part of my mind's not so active. Like, I can look around, I'm like, you know, I'm pretty content being who I am today. Sometimes I really watch this part of my mind during times of transition, like in my identity. There's a guy named Erickson that studied lifespan development, and he says that during different stages in our lives, we go through kind of mini identity crisis. We try to navigate changes in our identity. You know, from not having autonomy as an adolescent and wanting to find your identity as an individual person, as a 13, 14, 15, 16-year-old, wanting to be other than your family system, that's a normal part of lifespan development. You know, the wanting to be a mother, a father, if that is in your desire system, for some of us it's not. You know, and then the empty nest syndrome, right? When the kids go off, and then who am I? I'm not the mother I once was, or the husband, or the father that I once was. Who am I now? You know, some people are like, woohoo, I get to be something other than that. But sometimes these kind of navigating changes in identity, that's an interesting contemplation, is looking at all of the changes that occur in who we are and who we want to be. And this craving, this kind of, again, not having goals and aspirations. Like, I would like to, you know, be better, a better therapist. I would like to be, you know, maybe I'll work towards my doctorate. I would like to have these things. But it's kind of this, I can't be happy until I get. Or this sense of deficiency. You know, it's like this kind of, do we ever get there? Somehow our existential loneliness will be satisfied by becoming some other version of ourselves. And we see this materialize in the cultural level, this kind of wanting for stardom. You know, we are the primary suppliers of entertainment, this kind of fame, wanting to be someone. And this is something that a lot of people, spiritual teachers, also this kind of power gets abused. One, because they don't acknowledge that they have it, which is a big problem. Or because it has that drive of being someone that's of authority, wanting to be in roles where you can have authority and have influence. And again, when held, this is why this is all so complex, when held with that understanding that there is power, right? And that understanding and some accountability, other people that can call leaders out on their shit and see them as human, you know, with when it's held in a healthy system, it can thrive. But this is part of this coming to be is the ego wanting to be powerful, wanting to be respected, wanting praise, admiration. Not that those things in and of themselves are not wholesome, but it's our relationship to them, right? It's that very subtle level. And then the last thing is the vibhava tanha, which means the craving to not become. craving for non-existence, craving for getting rid of some part or all of an experience. So in subtle forms, we can see this to give some examples. And it's like how we treat aging and how we relate to the body that ages. This is a really simple way to contemplate the craving to not want. We don't want to exist in a body that ages. We value in our culture youth, right? They call senior citizens the forgotten generation. And it tends to happen over and over and over again because we so much value youth. And so there's this kind of like the subtle levels of not wanting to age and the subtle levels of also delusion that exists around our bodies getting older, our metabolism changing, right? These aspects of reality that we don't want to exist. And so again, in and of itself, sure, like we take care of our skin or our bodies however we want. But looking, being interested in like looking at how we want to deny what is, craving for something not to exist. And also this craving for non-existence also manifests as like depression. You know, this sense of not wanting to be here, not wanting to be in this, not wanting to be with this. This is what brought me to Buddhist practice. I couldn't find a way out. Drugs and alcohol worked for some time until they stopped. Someone says that you can never get enough of something that almost works. Almost worked until it didn't work. And then I entered into recovery, and that worked pretty well. I changed my behavior. I stopped lying and, being consciously manipulative, trying to live in integrity. I stayed clean day after day. My life got significantly better. But there was still the misery of my mind. There was still the self-views. There was still the leftover reasons why I used drugs and alcohol to begin with. And so I found myself wanting to not exist. We see this wanting the escape of suicide. I had a client of mine recently kill themselves, someone that I had been with for a year, unexpectedly. And there's this kind of stigma of talking about depression and the stigma of talking about, feeling out of place or feeling this dukkha that the Buddha was like, no, that is the way that it is. It's really hard. And that the only wise response to our pain is to practice compassion. To try to understand it, to try to be with it. To not have to fix it right away, to just exist in the space with it. And so how we learn to work with our reactivity, the craving to want the sensory input to feel good, the good sights and smells and tastes that we automatically go to wanting to become some version of ourselves, to wanting to not become the version that we are, is we learn how to slow down. So simple, it's easy to overlook. Just sitting here quietly with ourselves, spending time with ourselves. Slowing down the urgency to react, learning to allow ourselves to develop some non-reactive awareness, being with what is, equanimity. As we sit time and time again, we sit here and we watch the mind, we see the mind, and it becomes less personal. We don't have to buy in so much to its stories about who we are or why we're not the best or we're the worst or whatever. We start to see even the craving mind, the mind that says, I have to have this, as impersonal, as a passing mental moment. And it's hard to be with, I call it the crave wave. We learn how to ride the crave wave. and to get support around it and to share about it and to sit on our hands sometimes with it, but to just not pick up that thing. And then we learn that we can do that. And then we build confidence. The word sada, faith, from a Buddhist perspective, is not about believing in. It's about direct experience, moments of confidence that are built over time by seeing that you can not reach out and grab, that you can sit on your hands and get the support you need and ride the crave wave with non-reactive awareness and not judging ourselves for having the craving to begin with, which just creates this other type of insane shame spiral that we go down. And just being like, right now it's like this. It really is like this. It's really this hard. It's not my fault. It just is. It's not me. It's not who I am. It's the mind. And we learn to understand the mind. We learn to develop wisdom. We see its tricks, because then I don't pick up the thing and I know that I can get through it. And then the next time the mind says, hey, what about the X? We say, I see you, mind. Not going there tonight, right? I'm going to put that one away quickly. Focus on something else. The Buddha calls this careful attention, Yanasomanasikara. Be careful with our attention. He says the word for attention in Pali Sanskrit, manasikara, means making in the mind. Whatever you pay attention to gets made in the mind. So that thought comes up, you see it for what it is. That's a moment of suffering. That's a future moment of suffering I could get myself into. And you turn your attention to something that's going to help you through it. And instead of coulding and shoulding ourselves through experiences, we learn to care ourselves through them. Compassion, understanding, empathy, forgiveness. I was in my therapy office. I don't even know if I can articulate this yet because I haven't processed it. I was in my therapist's office this last week. I was sitting there for like 45 minutes just feeling all this like fear and anger and shame, like every emotion. And I just got mad at him. And I was like, I'll call him Tim. I was like, Tim, what do you want me to do with this? What am I supposed to do? I'm just supposed to be here and feel anger and then sad and then afraid. Like, what am I supposed to do this? And he was like, what if you could just sit there with that for right now? He's like, and I was like, thrown off by that. I was like, what does it mean to just sit with what's difficult? To give it time, to give it space. And that maybe compassion is just the willingness to be with what's hard. And the willingness to connect with others around what's hard. Instead of all the subtle ways that we tell ourselves that it shouldn't be. There's a really great t-shirt that a Dharma teacher that I love wears, and it says, nothing is wrong with you. And I like that, because that's like 9 times out of 10, I'll be walking by that shirt, and I'm like, oh, thanks for the reminder. So these are some of my thoughts. Craving, clinging.